Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker, and water connoisseur. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we all struggle with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Good afternoon, Elizabeth.
Good afternoon, Brian.
That's a big jug of water you're taking swigs of.
I drink a gallon a day. Is there something wrong with me?
No, that sounds very healthy.
So I've just given up trying to fill up dainty water bottles, and I just bring the gallon with me. So it's very ladylike, isn't it? If I drank it over my shoulder like a jug.
Right.
There we go. Like it was my moonshine. it's a beautiful day. Happy to be here. And it is pledge drive, right?
Yes.
But we're not going to be breaking in or disturbing the flow today, which is nice. But we did want to take a moment to remind people that if you enjoy this program and you enjoy all the programming here at KCBX, we ask you to contribute to the ongoing efforts of this wonderful public radio station. And you can express your appreciation for getting this kind of original programming by calling in
at 549-8855.
And making a donation of any amount. And there are premiums that are available that you can find out about. Those of you who are listening online, you are also welcome to call in, because I know that there is a cost to the station for all of the streaming that happens online. So as much as we love having you tune in on your devices, it does cost the station extra money for every single person who tunes in.
Yep.
So please do your part, because we do like doing this show. And also there's a little bit of that popularity contest thing that goes on. So we'd like to see, who's out there listening and who wants to let people know or let the station know that they value what we do here on Tuesdays at 2.
Right. When the time you pledge shows us what you're listening to at that time. So
exactly. So we know you're tuning in at 2. Uh-huh. So the number once again.
549-8855. And those of you listening on your streaming device, you could also just donate online at our kcbx.org website.
Oh, that makes it even easier.
Yeah.
And do it now, because we want you to get back on the phones to call in and contribute to today's conversation, which is a whole nother number.
Right.
So take care of the pledging and then get ready to use your dialing fingers to be part of today's conversation, which it's one of those weeks, and I always talk to my husband about it afterwards. I didn't talk to him before, that sometimes if I try to do something that's too many different directions, it makes it a challenge for listeners, I think, to know when to call in or which thing to call in about. So I'm hoping today that you'll kind of go with the flow of my topic, my overall topic, and then jump in with your reactions to whichever part of this topic resonates with you. Does that seem mysterious enough?
Yeah. It's like you could help follow our conversation or help direct it, depending on
exactly
what you have to add or ask.
Which is what makes the show so fun every week, is that I only have, what's going on in my head, and I have the topic and, kind of this general frameworked idea of what I want to share with everybody, what's on my mind. But yeah, the calls really determine which direction we go with it. So that does make it kind of fun, is that I'm never quite sure where we're going to go, and it keeps me on my toes. But it also, ultimately makes the conversation much more personal to our listening community. So that is fun. You do have the power to shape the conversation, which is very appropriate, because our conversation today is going to be about power and how it impacts our relationships in profound ways, and in ways we might not even recognize, and the power of language and how it shapes our behaviors and how we respond to different perceived concerns or threats or struggles that we're having. So the overall theme today is about power. And I'll tell you a little bit about why I decided to address power. But before we do that, I do want to remind everyone that you can be part of this conversation in many ways, not only calling in and sharing your thoughts or asking a question or making a comment, but we do have our website, thereluctanttherapist.com. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. And I really appreciate those who take the time to write and share their thoughts, because I really am interested in knowing how different conversations resonated with people in positive or negative ways. Always appreciate the feedback. You can listen to previous shows by subscribing through iTunes. It doesn't necessarily have to be iTunes either, right? If you go to the app on your iPhones. This is a little above my technology knowledge. But if you go to iTunes and you go to podcasting and type in A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, make sure it's a picture of me with the KCBX logo on it and hit subscribe. And then all of our shows will be downloaded to your device and you can listen at any time, which is exciting. And I think I told you that at one point my girls must have subscribed my phone to it because one day I was looking at my phone and there was this, you know, there was eight, it said apps and it had eight. And I said, what is this? I opened it and it was all my shows. I go, that's exciting. So now I want to pass on that little bit of wisdom to everyone else to be able to be a part of it. And you can also find out what we're going to talk about each week on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. And you can leave comments there and messages for me as well. So I think that gets us caught up. Let's talk about power.
Okay.
All right. So the last couple weeks, you know, 2 weeks ago, we talked about sex and sex education and how poorly in many ways we address sexuality. We teach about sexuality, how we express ourselves sexually, like all of the things that you think we should know naturally. Like we believe that all of our sexual knowledge should come naturally and we should know what we're doing. But in reality, you know, there is a lot that goes into it that is much more than the biology of our sexual relationships, that the intimacy piece of it, right? How we feel about our bodies and ourselves and how we feel emotionally and how secure we feel in our relationships impact the quality of our sexual experiences. And so it's a much more complex issue than just the biology of how do all the pieces go together. So we talked about that 2 weeks ago. And then last week we talked about the men's movement and the expanding of gender roles and ways for men to express themselves and kind of this need to help men have more ways to participate in the world than just kind of through the traditional gender roles of, you know, caregiver for the family or warrior out, you know, wreaking havoc on the world. And so that was last week's conversation. And the thing that we didn't address in either of the conversations was the role of power in our sexuality and in the idea of a men's movement. And the reason I decided we needed to talk about the role of power is because after the show, some of the feedback, because Brian and I both noted that all of our calls were from men last week.
That's right.
And usually we're a little more balanced between men and women. And I thought, where were all the women? And I got feedback off the air from women who were really concerned, you know, about this idea that do we want to empower men anymore, right? Do we want to give them an entire movement that says, you know, you even have more power in society? Because for a lot of women and feminists in particular, you know, part of the struggle that we have in culture is that we are out of balance, that the male masculine energy of our country dominates the power in the world, or in our country at least, but in the world in general. And so there's a lot of concern that by having, you know, a men's movement specifically helping men gain more power, that that's just going to make a larger separation between those who have power and those who do not. And so I understand that. I mean, I understand that concern. And I also understand that for men, the idea of a men's movement or moving towards more equality in relationships, because part of this idea of the men's movement is trying to make, you know, gender roles more diverse for men and women, which would also equate to having more equality in relationships. You know, if men want to do more of the caregiving and women are going to do more of the resource work, that kind of balances the power in relationships. Because what we understand about relationships and power is that he who makes the gold generally makes the rules, right? Those with the resources, bringing the resources to the family, tend to hold the power. And so consciously or unconsciously, you know, men are concerned about, and I think, I hope it's more unconsciously, this idea that if I give up power, if our relationship becomes more equal, then I lose control or I lose power or I lose authority and I become lesser than in some ways. So right there we have a challenge in relationships of how to make sure that both men and women are getting their fair shake. And if you've been in power, right, either perceived power or legitimately in power or actually have the power, it's difficult to let that go because we only understand the extremes. We're either in power or we're dependent. We're in power or we're powerless. Right? We don't talk a lot about what a balance of power looks like. And so whenever anyone feels they're slipping or losing their sense of power, they tend to become more assertive in trying to assert their power. Does that make sense? Okay. So that idea of power in relationships is really important to understand because I think that not understanding or not acknowledging kind of that elephant in the room of who is in charge or who has the power prevents us from really moving closer to a more equal or balanced experience in our relationships. And, you know, when I first started thinking about the topic, I thought, should we make it, you know, like a global idea of power? And I thought, that gets too broad. We can talk about political power. And in some ways, you can see with political parties that the more they sense they're losing power, the more they try to exert power or control. You know, I thought, no, we don't want to go there because that starts getting too lofty. So I wanted to bring the conversation of power really into how power plays out in our relationships. In general with our intimacy or in our interacting with our family members, because, you know, power in families is also very interesting. You know, how children are raised or how children perceive who's in charge or makes decisions influences their behavior in many ways. So I thought today we'd focus on how we experience power in our relationships. And then I also wanted to talk a little bit about power in language and how the way we use language can give us either the illusion of more power, but can actually give individuals or agencies or corporations more power. Just in the way that we talk about things can change power. So I'll talk a little bit about that in a moment, but I want to invite you to be part of this conversation. 805-781-3875. If you're just tuning in, I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I brought up the topic of power today and how that plays out in our relationships, kind of relating it back to the last couple of weeks where we talked about sexuality and talked about the men's movement. And what is it about power in both of those situations that makes it a challenge to come to some agreement or to find comfort in our relationships. And maybe we're talking about power when it comes to men and women, but we could also talk about power when it comes to families. And I want to talk a little bit about power in language, but you are invited to participate. 805-781-3875. Do you, Brian, when you think about your relationship, do you ever consciously think I need to maintain my authority here because I'm the man of the house?
I don't think so. I've never actually consciously thought much about the power between us because I've always felt it's pretty equal. And in fact, I feel like she holds more power than me. I know when we, you know, the first several years of our relationship, it was definitely like 50-50, felt super equal. But now she just works way more than me. She does all the meal planning and cooking, which is a huge task. And she cooks amazing meals and foods and freezer meal. Like our freezer and fridge are always just packed with whole nutritious stuff. And so I just kind of yield like, yes, whatever you say we're having, I'd love it. And
happy wife, happy life then. Is that what maybe, you've become?
Maybe.
Well, and it's interesting because what you're saying is what holds true in much of the research about power in relationships, that although men tend to hold the perceived power in relationships, most husbands will say that they believe their women, that their wives actually hold more power in the relationship. And so what we find is that because men sense or husbands sense that their wives actually hold more of the power in the relationship, that they tend to unconsciously or consciously try to hold power in other ways because they feel vulnerable, right? They feel like that they need their wives almost more than their wives need them.
I think I definitely fall into that category without realizing it until just now.
Well, so it's an interesting dilemma then, right? So if you're really unconscious of that dynamic and you definitely start to feel that your power or your relationship is out of balance or that you're losing kind of your importance in the relationship, that many men unconsciously then start to try to wield power in ways that causes more conflict in the relationship, right? Like, no woman of mine is going to go to work, or I'm trying to think of the kind of old traditional things that men would say, mm-hmm. when, especially during the feminist movement, you know, the reason the divorces were so high, the divorce rate was so high, is because men could feel, you know, the loss of their power, where they're kind of holding court and bringing in the resources and they had the little woman at home, that was so overwhelming that they started trying to put these absolute controls on, you know, my wife won't go to work or won't go back to school, or, you know, you're going to be home to make dinner at 6. And even if they didn't feel that on some deep level, it was more of the fear speaking of, I'm losing control and I'm not sure how to express how I'm feeling. Because if I talk about my feelings of losing control, then I will lose more control, right? Because men aren't empowered to say or speak about emotions and feelings. Because again, if we don't talk about emotions and feelings, we don't look vulnerable and we retain power. It's like, it's this dance that's very unconscious that I think a lot of men just grow up absorbing the dance because that's what they've seen being done. But underneath all of that dance really is this fear that if I show any weakness, I will lose my partner, and she's the source of my strength. And so that causes underlying conflicts, imbalances, and power in relationships, and one of the reasons why a lot of couples end up splitting up. Now, you might have someone come to my office or talk about we got divorced because of communication problems, or we fell out of love, or, you know, we had different goals. But really, at the bottom, a lot of these issues is power, is the imbalance of power in the relationships, or the unacknowledged imbalance in power, or even talking about power at all. Like, how will we do this thing so that we both are getting our needs met, because we aren't often trained in the language of power or language of relationships, we end up not talking about the issue, which is feeling powerless or empowered, and we fight about the toilet seat, right? That toilet seat is at the heart of a lot of conflicts in couples.
Right.
You know, if that toilet seat is left up, that says to me that I am not valued or in power in this relationship. And for a lot of men, leaving that toilet seat up is a kind of unconscious way of saying, I'm in power here, you put the darn seat down. And so you have couples that'll end up getting divorced because they think it was the toilet seat, but it really came down to who had the power in the relationship, or who felt they didn't have the power. And so that brings us to the sexual dynamic in relationships, right? The sexual power. And because men tend to have the force or the might, you know, we look at a lot of sexuality as being driven by the power of men, right? They can physically dominate a woman. And so we want to be very careful with power imbalances in sexual relationships, because we don't want a woman feeling coerced or feeling that she's been attacked or raped or done something that she did not want to do. So we're very careful with our language when it comes to sexuality. But not only is there a power dance when it comes to sexuality and dating, but sexuality in marriages. And quite often, again, it goes back to, you know, it looks like men have the power and determine, you know, what's going to happen in the relationship. But for many men, you know, if a wife feels like she is not getting the respect she deserves, or doesn't have the power she believes she should have, she can withhold sex, withhold affection, withhold intimacy as a way of exerting passive-aggressively her sense of powerlessness in the relationship, or trying to exert some sort of power. And so for men, that's devastating, because we talked about last week, you know, for most men in marriages, women tend to be their source of intimacy, their most intimate relationship, the person they talk to the most unguardedly about their feelings, if they talk to anyone about their feelings and emotions. And so when a woman starts to withhold that affection or that intimacy, men can feel panicked and then start to assert, right, the power, because they don't know how to say, hey, I'm feeling hurt or sad, or I want to be close to you, instead of saying those words, because again, the language of relationships is evasive for most of us, or eludes most of us. I can't think of the right word, but so not having the right language, we then turn to kind of our more primal reaction, which is, you know, I want to have sex with you, or that's your job, or you need to, you know, be intimate with me. And in the effort is to say, I want to be close to you and I love you, but it ends up becoming kind of this power struggle. You know, you're my wife, that's your job. And the wife says, no, that's not my job. You can't take that from me. And so instead of having this pleasurable experience of sharing sex together and having this close, intimate relationship, it starts to become a power battleground, right? Who's going to be in charge? Who's going to be able to hold their ground the longest before they give in? And so how do we address power? How do we address the power imbalances in relationships? It takes language. It takes the ability to let go of this perceived need for power and to trust that who we're handing power to, or, you know, sharing power with, is not going to then dominate us. I mean, it's a little bit of that trust, right? Who's going to flinch first, or I'll slide some power to you and hoping that you're not going to wield it over my head. I mean, there's a lot of gamesmanship in power in relationships. But if we all understood that coming together and sharing power in different ways in our relationship, that both people benefit, it's better for our mental health and well-being. No one really wants to be the leader in relationships at all times. When they look at male dominant patterns in relationships or in marriages, that in a male dominant pattern where the man tends to hold all the power and make all the decisions, men quite often get bored with that role of always being the leader, and it tends to undermine the quality of the relationship. They might lose respect for their wife. They start to stray. You know, they want to be challenged. In wife dominant patterns where the women hold all the power, the same thing happens. They start to resent the man for not taking more power or being more a part of it. And so ideally we look at an autonomic, to get too academic on you, an autonomic pattern of power where both husband and wife or both partners in the relationship have power in specific areas, you know, where they might have more knowledge or more authority. Like maybe someone is in charge of all the insurance papers in the family, and someone's in charge of raising the children, and someone's in charge of, you know, taking care of all of the family relationships, and to have that kind of shared power in areas that we have expertise. And that's kind of the ideal in a lot of power relationships. So I'm curious to know, you know, how does power work in your life? Is it possible to ever come to a place of equality in relationships? And do you think that this translates out to the world? Can we ever really have equality in the workplace? Can we have equality in politics? Can we have equality in marriages? Because there's so much anxiety wrapped into holding power or losing power that will we ever be able to get to a place where anyone can actually let it go enough to appreciate or get to the place where they enjoy actual equality without that fear or vulnerability of, if I let go of power, I now become dependent. I'm curious to know what you think about this. 805-781-3875 is a number to be part of this conversation. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. So do you think it's possible? I mean, when I look at this research and I look at, you know, power, let's talk about the definition of power, because it's really hard to define or describe power as an absolute, this is what power is. I mean, the broad definition is the ability to do or act, political or national strength, the possession of control or command over others, and authority. So that's kind of the broad definition of power. But it's really hard to describe what it looks like or feels like until you don't have it. And you go, oh, yeah, I know what that feels like. Or when you have power and you might feel like, oh, I know what this feels like. And it's interesting because Bertrand Russell wrote a book in 1938 about social power and how his theory was that all human beings are innately driven by a lust for power. And that, there's never really an opportunity for equality, because as soon as someone feels like they are have everything they need and they feel satiated by all the things that they need or feel like they need or want, it ignites in them a curiosity or desire to obtain more and more material items or power or wealth. And so it's almost like unconscious we are driven to pursue more power once we seem to have whatever it is we think we need in a relationship. That's Bertrand Russell's thought on it, on social power. So I don't know. So that's the power for relationships part. But I wanted to also address power in language, because on Sunday I went to a performance, I guess it was performance, at the PAC by Frank Warren. Are you familiar with his work?
No, I think I heard someone talking about it, that show, though.
Yeah, so it's called Post Secret. And I feel a little, you know, out of the loop, because apparently Post Secret's been around for over a decade. And a decade ago, Frank Warren started this, he had this idea that he would ask people to send their secrets on a postcard. And he would, I'm not sure, I guess what the idea was, that it would release the secret from them, you know, because if we hold secrets, holding secrets can make us ill, right? It makes us feel inauthentic. It can hurt our mental health and well-being. It can make us feel stressed. And so it was like, unburden yourself of these secrets. And then he started posting these secrets every week on a website, the Post Secret website. And it's interesting. And people tend to decorate their cards in really elaborate ways. So it's kind of fun to see how artistic and creative people were with posting their secrets. And so if you're familiar with Frank Warren, I'd love to know your take on it, or why you were drawn to Post Secret and that whole idea also. Because again, it's not something I was familiar with, and it's been around for a decade. I think it's one of the, you know, most highly visible and most often visited sites on the web. So that was interesting to me. 805-781-3875 is the number if you want to chime in on any of those thoughts, and especially about the idea of Post Secret, because I wasn't aware of it. And also because what I'm going to say about my experience with Post Secret might rub those who are fans of Frank Warren's the wrong way. But I needed to talk about it because it goes along with this idea of power and the power in language. So in his talk, he was showing a lot of these different slides, and I thought it was fascinating to read people's secrets. And then he talked about his own journey, and he's raised, I think, over $1 million for suicide prevention, which I find amazing, and just quietly, you know, taking on this effort, because suicide is one of the fastest growing health concerns that we have. And I don't know if you saw that they're on the Cree Nation reservation in Canada, they've had multiple suicide attempts. I think there were 11 in the last month.
Yeah.
So suicide is a huge growing issue. So Frank Warren's been dedicated to trying to raise awareness about that and suicide prevention. But he also talks about mental health and mental illness, and how when people hold that secret of a mental illness, that it prevents them from getting help or getting better, right? That the whole idea of stigma around mental health, mental illness. And so I admire that also, because we want people to not feel ashamed or embarrassed. I mean, the whole definition of stigma, right, is the shame around an experience or a condition. But here's where I got a little issue with Frank Warren is the way we talk about mental health has shifted over the last 20 or so years. That, you know, 20 plus years ago, when I started doing this, when people had anxiety or depression, and I'm not talking about major depressive disorder or bipolar disorder, but you know, situational depression, seasonal depression, anxiety, anything from panic attacks to social anxiety to phobias, you know, when people had those issues, they were called mood disorders. Generally, they were called a mood disorder. You're, you know, suffering from a mood disorder. And then there was a shift from calling them mood disorders to mental disorders. And so then once we started calling anxiety and depression mental disorders, that kind of bumped them up in this category. That language change bumped up the severity in the idea or minds of people. And all of a sudden we see a great rise in the diagnosis of mental disorders and people, you know, having more medications because of them. And we shifted away from talk therapy, which used to be kind of the essence of working with mood disorders, but with mental disorders, because it sounds like like it's more critical and more, you know, disease oriented, that we start getting more funding. And I understand that, but more awareness of it when you start saying mental disorder. But then in the last 5 or 10 years, we've bumped up these same mood disorders to mental illnesses. And once you categorize them as a mental illness, although the intent is to reduce the stigma around, you know, suffering or struggling with a mood disorder, that's the intent by it, to raise awareness of, you know, the impact that a mood disorder has on someone's life. Because if you struggle with panic attacks or anxiety or, you know, depression, it changes the course of your life. It impacts your day-to-day living. But once you attach it to mental illness, I believe that change in language stigmatizes people more, because it puts a disease spin on it. And so people feel more ashamed or nervous or concerned about talking about it. And I am more concerned because I think that it disempowers the individual who's struggling with a mood disorder to feel like they have any control over how they're going to proceed or get better, that it takes the power away from the person to be able to take steps to deal with, live with, tolerate whatever their mood disorder is. And now it's in a disease category where they feel like, I have no power over this. I can only get better if I seek help outside of myself. And so that shift in language, I think, shifted the power of healing when it comes to our mental health out of the hands of the individual and into more of that, the mental health industry. I don't know. So what do you think about that? I guess I'm the only one, you know, who thinks about these power issues. Or again, maybe I thought it was a little too complex of a thing to throw out there, power in our relationships. Maybe we don't like to talk about, you know, the power in our relationships because it makes us feel vulnerable. Maybe we don't want to admit that we don't have power in our relationships, or we don't think about it. We just kind of accept that it is the way it is. But if we don't talk about power when it comes to sexuality, then we continue to have rising numbers of sexual assaults, I think, on campuses, because our inability to talk about power in society and power in relationships. You know, I think that for a lot of young men, when they see women doing better, I mean, women are excelling on college campuses, right? Women are higher numbers in grad schools and undergraduate programs. And so that once domain where men felt like they were the standouts in classrooms and they were the, you know, smarter or more powerful sex, when that starts to shift, then you start to see people exerting power and control in different ways. And it makes sense that sexually you would see this kind of imbalance in power where men are trying to grasp for a way that they retain their power in society. I mean, not talking about it doesn't make it go away. And unaddressed issues like who holds power and how do we hold power can only cause us trouble. So 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of this conversation. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. We'll be back to take your calls.
And if you'd like to pledge your support to KCBX and in support of Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist, you can call us at 549-8855 or donate at kcbx.org. Again, the number to speak with Elizabeth right now, live and in person, that number is 805-781-3875. Again, 781-3875.
Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And we're talking today about power, which is a broad, broad topic. I understand that. But narrowed down to the idea of power in relationships and the power of language and how it impacts our own feelings of power or disempowerment, and also power in our relationships, because how we speak to each other in our relationships also determines how comfortable or secure we feel in the relationships we're involved in. you know, when someone feels threatened in a relationship, if they feel like they're losing power, they tend to go on the offensive and tend to use more verbal attacks as a way of trying to reestablish their power in that relationship. And again, a lot of it, most of it's unconscious. We're not consciously thinking, ooh, I'm feeling bad about myself. I'm feeling like I'm not respecting this relationship, or I don't have the power to make decisions, so I'm going to start attacking my partner. It's kind of this gut reaction or this reaction to a sense that we have. And then we respond in a way that, again, raises conflict in relationships and can end up destroying that relationship. And it all came down to that, not simple, but the idea of how do we share power in relationships? You know, from a social science point of view, there's a couple different theories on power that drive relationships. And one is the resource theory of power. And the resource theory of power basically is he who makes the gold makes the rules, right? Whoever brings in the most resources has the power in the relationship. And traditionally, men have held power in marriages because they were the primary breadwinners in relationships. And we don't esteem caregiving in relationships on any high level of any sort. So the idea was that men held power to make decisions and to determine the course of the family's life because they were making the money. So if the husband got a job outside of, you know, in a different state, the family's going to pick up and move. Had a lot to do with the resource power. But if the idea of the resource power, theory of power, were really true or universal, then you would think as we see the shift in roles, because in a lot of families, and Brian, you talk about your family, you know, if the wife is making more money and bringing in more resources to the family, then you would assume that she would then hold the power in the relationship. But what they found is that even with the changing of resources in relationships or in families, that hasn't given women more power in the overall decision-making of family systems. But conversely, men more often will say that their women hold, their wives hold power in the relationship, and that they feel like one of the only things that they contribute to the family is the financial resource well-being. And so they kind of hold dearly to that as their source of power, or at least give them some power, because they don't necessarily do the child rearing or make the food or, you know, determine how the house is going to be decorated, what their social life is even like, that their resource power was their one place they were holding power in the relationship. And so now with this shift, with so many women making as much, if not more, as their husband, then we're seeing this power imbalance get even larger, where now women tend to hold more power, and that is a source of more potential conflict in relationships. The other theory of power is the principle of least interest. And I always find this one fascinating because it holds true not just for marriages, but also for dating relationships. And the principle of least interest is that the person who is least vested in the relationship holds the most power. So the person who is most dependent on the relationship for their emotional or financial well-being is the person who's most vulnerable. And the person who's least vested holds all the power, because at any time they can say, I'm over it, I'm going to go. And so the other person tends to acquiesce or give in more or feel disempowered or vulnerable because they fear losing that relationship they have. So then when you feel disempowered in a relationship, how do you get any power, right? How do you give yourself any sense of having power in the relationship? So that's where you start to see a dynamic of withholding affection, withholding intimacy, withholding sexuality, to give some sort of sense that I do have some power in this relationship, even though, you know, my husband, or even if it's the wife who's the least interested, somehow you're trying to maintain that dance. So I don't know. I mean, it's funny. I thought this conversation would be more of a spark, but maybe it's just too lofty and no one cares about it. So then what about the idea of Frank Warren's post-secret? And I'm surprised that people aren't more activated by that, because, as I said, it's the most widely visited site on the web. And so I'm curious to know if people go to the post-secret website, and why do they go? What have they found of value to it? or with it. And my thoughts about the whole language of mental health, how we moved from, you know, anxiety and depression from being a mood disorder to now a mental illness, and has that helped reduce the stigma, or has it in some ways increased it? So I'm curious to know how you feel about this. 805-781-3875 is the number to call to be part of this conversation. And the other thing that was interesting about this performance on Sunday afternoon was that he opened up the phone lines at the end of the show and invited people to come up and talk about, share their secrets. There was an open mic, come up and share your secrets. And I'm always amazed to see the people who will go up and talk in front of a large room like that, because I would never get up and do that. You know, and I do this for a living. I'm a lecturer. I do the show. You know, I do speaking engagements. I do this for a living, and I would never get up and talk on this mic or share a secret in front of the room. So I admire the people, and I'm always curious about the people who really do take that on and get up and talk. But what was interesting is that almost every person who got up and spoke, their secret had something to do with social anxiety and the fear of, you know, speaking in public or being in public places. And they really wanted to take this opportunity to test themselves, to do something out of their comfort zone, which I found fascinating, because that is a great first step. Because if I were, you know, when I work with people with anxiety, that's kind of our main focus, is how do we learn to tolerate the discomfort and actually go into the eye of the discomfort and face it head on. But the other thing that I thought was interesting, and the part that again made me want to talk about this stigma and the idea of mental health or mental illness, was when did social anxiety become a mental illness? Because it's a normal response to a very overwhelming experience. You know, for almost anyone going into a social situation is going to make us anxious. That is a normal response. But somehow along the way, you know, it became a mental illness, which I think in some ways caused people to shut down even more and feel fearful of even trying to address social anxiety, because they've been told that it's an illness in some way. So I'm curious to know what you think about that. 805-781-3875. Whitney, what's on your mind today? Whitney, are you there?
Hi, I'm here. Sorry,
hi.
I cut out for a second.
That's okay. What's on your mind?
So I actually wanted to talk about the post-secret.
Okay, great.
So post-secret for me, I discovered it shortly after high school. Maybe around like senior year, sometime after high school, about when it started to come out. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was a really great thing, and for a lot of my friends at the time, because we were able to see that other people were going through a lot of the same things that we were going through, that other people had these same sort of experiences that we didn't, you know, realize that were normal or anything like that. And so I think that it kind of helped us a lot, sort of grow as people and to realize that we're not so different from other people, that we're not alone. So I just wanted to share like what my experience with it was with you. So I know you went to that show, and that might have been fabulous. But for me, going through that and being able to see that I was not alone at a time when, you know, things are so difficult, mm-hmm. being a 17, 18-year-old girl, I thought it was super beneficial.
I agree, because I loved the idea in theory of the postcards. I love going through the site and seeing how much time people put into you know, creating their art and sharing their secret and normalizing the experiences. But I guess the part for me which was missing is, once we've normalized it, then how do we help embrace how normal we actually are and go forth in our life? Because it feels like that the sharing of the secret of whatever the anxiety is, or the suicidal ideation, or, you know, the dark thoughts that we have, especially as adolescents, once we've normalized it, then what's the step to helping people just embrace who they are, the way they are, and not have it regress backwards to being, and now you're part of a group of people who have an illness. You know what I'm saying? It's like,
I completely understand. For me, I, at that time, I found great solace in like the internet and finding other people that I could talk to that had experienced the same things or are thinking the same things, and being able to just talk about it. And even though I didn't know these people were on the opposite side of the country or whatever, finding people who I could talk to about it even if they weren't, you know, people that I knew, was really great for me. And it helped me sort of open up and think about the idea of, like, mental illness. But I don't necessarily like to see, like, what I, you know, my experiences of, like, a mental illness. I much prefer the mood disorder. Mm-hmm. But it just, I think the idea of going and being able to talk, like, the post-secret sort of opened the door to, for me, being able to go and talk to people about it.
So did it empower you? Did it make you feel like I'm
Absolutely.
Not broken? Because that's the thing that I keep hoping is that I want people to walk away with the I'm not broken feeling, therefore I'm now going to attack my life in more powerful ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And it did. It for me, it made me feel, because I wasn't alone, I felt like I had more power. Like, I felt that, okay, other people think these same kinds of things. Other people deal with these things. I'm more powerful to go out and figure out how to help myself.
Great. And I'm glad that it had that impact on you, because I can see that as the benefit of being able to tap into that that population or that group. And I have to know, did you send in a secret to him?
I don't think so. I remember, like, creating things or coming up with some ideas. I don't know if I ever sent them in. It was like 10, 11 years ago. I have no idea. But I remember writing, and I remember at that time I started blogging. Mm-hmm. And I got on a site that was really interactive with the members. So it wasn't just you were blogging and maybe someone will see it. It was you blogged and it went to the front page of the site and people could see it. People could come and read what you were saying. They could comment. You could, you know, I actually have some really good friends that I see maybe once a year, if that, like, that I made from this blogging site. And it was so beneficial to me to know, to go and be able to, you know, see what other people are doing. And it's just, I think for me, PostSecret just sort of opened that up.
That's fantastic. Whitney, thank you for calling and sharing your experience. Especially
because
I am.
Thank you for being here.
I'm so late to the party. Enjoy the rest of your afternoon.
All right, you too. Bye-bye.
This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, if you're just tuning in. We're talking about power, and we're talking about PostSecret and this phenomenon created by Frank Warren, where people send in their secrets anonymously, and he posts them on their website, not all of them. And, you know, it's interesting, Brian, because he showed this huge pyramid of, I want to say millions, but hundreds of thousands of secrets that he's received over the last 10 years, and they are now moving it to a Smithsonian exhibit.
Wow.
To display all of these different secrets people send in. I mean, it's quite a movement. It's quite a large thing. But I did walk away from it. As I said, I loved the idea of being able to off a secret from us, because the other thing about it is that he talked a lot about the importance of sharing secrets and not holding them in, and that, you know, when we hold in secrets, it can make us sick. And I understand that, because absolutely, you know, that which we don't talk about can really do great harm to our immune system and to our mental and physical health. But the other thing I would have liked him to have said was that it's not always safe to share your secrets with everyone in your life. You know, that for some people, the ability to send out in a secret and be anonymous is phenomenal, because for many people to say to a spouse, you know, some deep secret that they've been carrying could shift the quality of that relationship. Like, I think the unfortunate thing is that in many relationships, we have to be careful about what we share. And that's disappointing, because we'd love to think that we're always going to be able to be open and talk about anything we want to. But I think in some ways we have to pay attention to those things that we share. And it goes back again to the power in relationships, or how do we, you know, dance with each other, and what is it that keeps us attracted, or what is it that, you know, builds trust, or, you know, so it's an interesting thing, because when we hold a secret about infidelity, or we hold a secret about sexuality, then we are potentially doing great damage to that relationship. But at the same time, there's other secrets, maybe about fantasies, or, you know, other things that we think about, sharing every dark thought we have, that could also alter the nature of that relationship. So it's an interesting dance we do. You have a couple more minutes to get in on this conversation if you have a thought about Frank Warren or PostSecret, or also what I mentioned before, that how did this language in talking about mood disorders, anxiety, depression, social anxiety, you know, some of the more mid-range levels of mood disorders, get elevated up the scale of language till now where they are lumped into this idea of being a mental illness. And once we are told we have a mental illness, does it disempower us from feeling like we can actually change our life and do something different? And how did we get to this change in language? How do we go from mood disorder to mental illness to kind of encapsulate every range of mental health concern on the spectrum? Because I think that that's done a great disservice to a lot of people. I think it in some ways stigmatizes them from reaching out and getting help. And also, Frank Warren talked about how once we, you know, talk about mental health concerns and we talk openly about what we struggle with, whether it's, you know, anxiety or depression or phobias or whatever that is, and once we say it out loud, that's the pathway to healing and hope and change. But the other little secret is that we don't have a one-size-fits-all pathway to healing once you do admit or discover or find out that you have a mood disorder or a mental health concern. And so that also is really a challenge, that a lot of people are struggling and suffering with anxiety and depression and phobias and OCD and different anything that prevents us from enjoying a high quality of life. Many people struggle with these things. And we see it on the rise because we have more sick people or people struggling with mental health issues. It's because situationally and environmentally, we have a lot more challenges that are causing people to react with anxiety and depression. It would be a normal reaction to very stressful life that we tend to live. But when we fail to let people understand that they're not sick, but quite possibly the lifestyle they're trying to adapt to or the culture that they're trying to keep up with or the materialism that they're chasing after is causing them to have these symptoms, you know, that change in language can make the difference between someone actually feeling better or going more deeply into the disorder or the you know, mood disorder or whatever they're struggling with. And because we don't have a set, if you've got a panic disorder, or if you have anxiety, or if you have depression, come in and here's what we'll apply as our fix-all and you're going to be better. Since we don't actually have that in the medical field or in the therapeutic field, it's an art, it's a dancing with, it's a figuring out how each individual best responds to different forms of treatment or ways of healing. To tell someone, once you admit you have this struggle, it's the path to healing, that also sets people up for failure, because there isn't always a guaranteed healing. For most people, they're going to find ways to live with and tolerate their mood disorders rather than ever really heal from it permanently. They can have symptoms reduced, but the idea of healing from it, I think, again, makes it sound like you've caught the flu, that's a disease, and we're going to, you know, go on antibiotics and rest and it's going to go away. That's a much different thing than, you know, struggling with panic or anxiety or social fears or phobias. It takes a different course of treatment. So I don't know. Does it make you curious to go on the website and check out what they're doing?
It makes me want to post a secret.
You do want to post a secret? Yeah. Would you tell me your secret?
I don't know. I'd let you go and look through the millions and try and guess which one was mine.
He told some great stories about, you know, people who'd posted secrets and then someone responded to their secret and it ended up being their best friend, but they didn't know it was their best friend.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, some wild stories. And a lot of it, again, which I really support, was the suicide prevention piece. You know, that in so many people's lives, that one person calling at that one moment and saying, hey, I'm thinking about you, how are you doing, can prevent someone from committing suicide. I mean, that kind of power is incredible. Or if, you know, posting these dark thoughts and sharing that secret helps someone feel like they're not alone, then that's phenomenal to have that kind of impact. And clearly, you know, for Frank Warren, he's raised over $1 million in suicide prevention at a time like this, especially for adolescents. And, you know, as Whitney was talking about, that this came to her at an important time in her life when she was an adolescent, to know that you're not alone can save a life, right? Can make the difference between life and death. So I don't know. 805-781-3875. Hi, Linda, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi. This is a very difficult call for me to make, but I'd like to talk about the imbalance of power in terms of workplace bullying, which happened to me for over the last several years, to the point where this person finally succeeded in getting, you know, me to lose my job. When you go through something like that, how can you get your own personal power back? You know, it's just, I feel like I've got PTSD where I'm just kind of walking around in circles because it was such a horrible experience.
Can you tell me a little more, Linda, about what exactly happened in the workplace? How you, was it a lack of power you had? Was it someone who had the authority? Can you tell me a little bit more?
My boss, basically, I think she has a personality disorder, and she tends to, she's targeted other older women that have worked there. Mm-hmm. And she got to the point where she was constantly criticizing everything I did, timing me on everything I did, getting behind me when I was working and making comments about, can you go any slower and stuff like that. And I know I was doing a good job. I know I was doing a good job. And it was just a case of where she had decided she wanted me out of there. And so she just made life miserable and then basically told stories to upper management. Even my coworkers were not backing me up on it. They saw what was happening, and they just, kind of laughed about it.
I'm sorry that you experienced this, and I wish it was an uncommon story because it shouldn't be happening. And unfortunately, it's a very common story. One, especially you mentioned, being an older worker, we have an environment in workplaces now that are very unfriendly to older workers. And there is kind of this industry-wide, across all industries, push to kind of force older workers out of the workplace. So that is happening. It wasn't your imagination.
Yeah.
And so maybe there's a little, sense of relief in that it wasn't anything that you did. And quite often, if a boss feels threatened by a coworker or an underling that might have more knowledge or more experience, they feel threatened. And so they exert the power to try to move them out. So I think for the healing and moving forward piece is to discover areas of your life where you actually feel empowered, a place that you have expertise or, that you are an authority in. Can you think of any of those places?
I was in that job for so long that the things that I used to do I haven't done in so long that I don't feel empowered in them anymore.
So what were they? Let's think about it. Did you have a hobby that you enjoyed and excelled at?
I guess just basically my love of nature and animals.
Hmm.
And also I'm very interested in healing touch and things like that, Reiki and healing touch and things like that.
When was the last time you allowed yourself to go to Reiki?
It's been a couple of years now.
All right. So I wish you'd called earlier, Linda, because I could spend a half hour with you. I'd love to. I think this is a topic that's so important to a lot of people, and maybe we'll have to revisit the whole idea of the workplace empowerment. But I'm going to give you a couple things. I encourage you to go be with animals and to get out in nature, to go someplace where nothing has power over you and you have the opportunity to give to others, right? To be out in nature and feel good and empowered, because no one can take that experience inside of you away from you.
Right.
That feeling of awe of going to Montano de Oro or any beautiful place will refill that sense of empowerment in you, right? When we own our sense of awe, it makes us feel mighty. And then if you love animals, if you go and hold them and pet them and spend some time maybe at woods or the pound or wherever you are, and to share that, that will also fill you with that sense of your own authentic power. And then to go back to Reiki if you can afford to go a few times, because I know nothing builds that inherent sense of wellness in us than that touch and being touched and knowing that we are valuable and worth being touched and loved. So I throw those three things to you. And I appreciate you taking the time to call. And please call again when we have more time. But I hope those three things help a little. And call back and let me know if they did. We do have to wrap things up today. And as always, I appreciate everyone participating in the show. Even though this was probably a more challenging conversation, we'll be back again next week. Please take some time to pledge to this radio station, KCBX, to show your support for this and other programming,
549-8855.
And you can also go to our website, kcbx.org, to pledge. And you can contact me, Elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com, or through Facebook. I look forward to speaking to you again next week. Thank you for supporting Public Radio KCBX.